that has experienced thriving times in the past. But here in the 21st century, Mali is devastated. Once a land of significant architectural development that denoted an accomplished civilization, these mementos are fading and might one day be all but forgotten. Villagers, seemingly unchanged by historical events of the past, live next to the remnants of centuries-old kings' palaces. In Mali, Senegal, and other countries, including Ghana and Niger, governments were feudal and consecutive royal dynasties ruled over this region. This place that you see here is the government's court. It is a royal's property that belongs to Bambara dynasty. The Dagon tribe is one of the most mystifying tribes in Mali. Some believe they are in regular contact with extraterrestrial beings. They are deeply knowledgeable about the stars and heavens. Deserted but resilient homes of the Dagons stand deep in the heart of the Bandiagara land. Among several such villages, one or two allow visitor access, while the rest are categorized as a forbidden zone for any non-native.
Did you know that these small houses belong to pygmies who built them more than 2,000 years ago?
Do you mean the tribes of short people?
Yes, the pygmies were forced to emigrate from here and move to Central Africa, to a country which is now involved in a horrible civil war. About 1,000 years ago, the Dagons migrated to this area. They were also natives of Bandiagara, but there were theological differences with the Muslim community there, and the Dagons didn't want to abandon their traditional customs. So they decided to emigrate and resettle within this territory to form their own society. This new land proved a very good place for them to live and grow. The environment meant that they were protected from wild animals and hostile tribes could not effectively attack them either. These are the reasons, it is said, that the Dagons took over this territory and ousted the pygmy population, who were the original builders of these houses.
The meaning of the black means the mud, the soil, the tail, and then the white means the water. And the skies, and then the red means the sacrifice blood, animals, and that is the sun over there.
They said they should be there to be away to see enemies coming from a distance, because sitting there you can see back of the plain land, and then if there is enemy coming you can see, and they can't come from your up, they will fall
but
down.
But how could they get, you know? The food and the water from?
They get their food and water. They come to hunt and then they go up their back. Enemies will not be fighting you all the time of the day.
It could be difficult for them, you know, just to coming down.
That is why today you see them living downstairs.
Yes.
The people of this village are origin of this place. But the present people of today are nothing belongs to them. But, it, you know, it's from great grandfather
generation
to
after generation,
after generation, and they are all here to protect it.
It was a time of long, dark nights, but brilliant days full of optimism and accomplishment. Legendary civilizations that were no less than those of the great ancient civilizations. Tribes that built impenetrable resistance could not be dominated by their enemies, and they prevailed. Faces of heroes were carved proudly on totems as mementos and as symbols of strength and fortitude. One might imagine these civilizations as primitive, but in many ways, they were not. Timbuktu is a gem in the heart of the African desert, a legendary city first established as a major commercial center in West Africa 900 years ago. Today, it is remote and desolate. Islam became prominent in Mali in the 1300s under the leadership of Mansa Musa, who built 5 mud-brick mosques, creating the beginning of an empire. The religion took its inhabitants out of paganism to the worship of one almighty God. Prior to Islam, the mystical traditions of Sufism were imbued in Malian society, and while Islam penetrated the indigenous consciousness of the people, local customs and beliefs persisted also. The period produced economic prosperity and attracted many Muslim scholars and traders. Today, Muslims make up 90% of Mali's population. Until recently, its society lived in relative peace with one another, tolerant of minority religions, and integrated into societal norms. Sufism in Mali has been the origin of many defining moments that includes successful resistance against colonialism. These are numerous sects in Mali Sufism. One of the most important and most followed is Tijuana. But all of these sects are devoted followers of the Ahlul Bayt, people of the house of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which includes the Imams of Islam.
Go to work there to see the people, to talk with the people, to don't make it again.
To solve the problem
to
peacefully.
To solve problem for the peace, not for the girl. Yeah, to talk with them, and then Mali will be nice country with them, to talk to them, not for the fighting. The Muslims pray every time they are good at it.
What about the French soldiers? There are plenty of them here.
French soldiers. Many is here.
The presence of the French in Africa, especially in Mali, is a story of centuries of attempts at imperial conquest and colonization.
From 1905 to 1932, here has been the seat of a French ruler. Now, what had happened during these 27 years in these houses?
And what decisions were made?
God knows.
In the majority of their captured colonies in Western Africa, the Fringe have spread radicalism, which adopts the belief that one race is superior over another race of people, and it is this radicalism that ensures colonies fulfill their responsibilities towards their lords. French soldiers are committed to fight for France's imperial interests, and the people of Mali must share their earnings and wealth with their colonial lord. The statue of Louis Archinard, a revered general of France's conquest of Mali in the 1800s, looks in the direction of Niger Beach, in a corner of the historic city of Sego, as a daily reminder that Malians are under French control. Mali gained its independence in 1960. However, slavery has persisted to this day. The French are well known throughout their own history as world-class enforcers of slavery, oppression, and even genocide. And so, for the people of Mali, there is likely to be no freedom from slavery when this French intervention changes form. When the war ends in Mali and everything reverts back to normal, lords remain lords, and slaves must continue their slavery. The war will become history soon enough, and the period of French colonialism will also one day end to make way for so-called democratic government. But the benefits reaped by the conquerors from natural resources will continue covertly, leaving only the crumbs for the native population. Mali possesses a wealth of vital natural resources such as petroleum, gas, and uranium, used for atomic weaponry, and the functioning of nuclear reactors. It provides abundant wealth to large French corporations, such as Arba. Arba, founded in 1958 in Paris, had always been at the top of French nuclear negotiations. The company is involved wherever African uranium is mined, and Mali is no exception. Tragically, while French politicians and business moguls enjoy their spoils and media spin, and a new government favorable to French interests is formed for Mali to complete its recolonization, the people of Mali will pay the ultimate price, that of widespread poverty forced upon them in order to guarantee control over their resources. It's difficult to imagine the horror these people must have witnessed in the throes of civil war, neighbor warring against neighbor, brother against brother. It all must have made little sense to those in the firing line. The people's expectations would have been vastly different from the terrible reality that ensued. Who will bind the nation's wounds once this is all over? Disintegrated economy, starving infants, poverty and unemployment directs most everybody towards violence as a last resort, and especially when there are serious external motives. Tuaregs are nomadic tribes in the north of Mali. One can find Tuaregs eking out a living from Libya and Algeria to the north of Mali. They are a people who feel always deprived and ready to protest. After Mali's independence, Tuareg tribes became a target of the French colonists, who sought to motivate them against the central government and thereby to weaken the new government. A weak central government can be easily corrupted and taken over by a colonial power. This time, Arab allies of Western powers and manipulation of the petrodollars would serve to help hoist the blood-covered flag of Takfiri terrorists over captured territory. The modus operandi of these Takfiris is to first destroy buildings that belong to the Sufis that brought Islam to Africa and fought against colonialists. Takfiris are exceedingly brutal in their methods of spreading fear through decapitation, torture, and rape and murder, that it would frighten the Malians in a way that they will never forget. With the intrusion of foreign-sponsored terrorists and mercenaries, the future for Mali was laid out. Northern cities would fall one by one, and the Black Flag government would replace Malian government and would rule over Mali. The Malian army is not able to confront such a level of threat that worked its way closer to the capital moment by moment. The increasing fear of a Takfiri takeover would strongly encourage Malian authorities and its people to welcome past occupiers. The French army simply waited in the wings for their chance to act and return to recolonize Mali, only this time as the role of perceived savior. It would then proceed to expel the Takfiris and take over Mali's northern cities itself, one by one. Timbuktu, formerly the cultural capital of Western Africa, was attacked by the terrorist group Ansar ed-Din, linked to Al-Qaeda, who saw their opportunity in the confusion following the military coup which ousted the former Malian government in 2012. Timbuktu became the training academy for Al-Qaeda terrorists. Today, Timbuktu is charged as the keeper of sacred scripts and treasures, which are under protection in selected libraries of the city. Once a cultural heritage burns in the fire of ignorance and prejudice, or is stolen and sold to private collectors, museums, or to London or Paris antique markets, the people no longer have that pillar of strength to lean on. It's as if a part of them has been taken and is now missing from their soul. And after that, their power to resist diminishes. Timbuktu's burnt books is the symbol of the rich and brave culture of the people who resisted against enemy attacks and threats of destruction of its antiquities for hundreds of years. Malians have been bent, but haven't broken. They have withstood countless invasions and persecutions, and all the while have kept their customs, culture, and religion. For the past 3 years alone, they have dealt with a government takeover, civil war, foreign terrorism, as well as local terrorism and rebellion, displacement of masses of people, government collapse, and destruction of the country's most endearing artifacts. Mali could be described as a failed state. The people have endured this traumatic experience, and there remains cautious optimism for the future. This is a testament to their strength of character. The country has lost some of its sovereignty. However, it is hard for one to be optimistic about the independent future of Mali. Already having lost some of its sovereignty to former colonial master France, Mali struggles both against foreign-sponsored terrorism and the relentless interference in its internal affairs by the West.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Health experts have warned against what they called a twindemic of COVID-19 and flu this coming winter season, according to a news report. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Elisha Machado, journalist. This article is published under the heading Health Experts Warn of Possible Twindemic as Flu Season Approaches. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As COVID-19 cases continue to drop and people scale back on protocols, doctors say there is concern that more people will catch the flu this year than last year. Health experts are warning of what could be a twindemic this year as flu season approaches during the COVID-19 pandemic. Doctors say the last flu season was mild because people were limiting social gatherings and wearing masks. The U.S. is gearing up in case of a bad flu season on top of the continuing COVID-19 crisis, with a plea for Americans to get vaccinated against both. Dr. Rachel Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said, "I get it. We are all tired of talking about vaccines, but it is doubly important this year to get your flu shot," added Walensky, who got her own vaccination earlier this week, just as she has every year since she was a medical student in 1995. She said, "We are preparing for the return of the flu in the U.S. However, as coronavirus cases continue to drop and people scale back on these protocols, there is concern that more and more people will catch the flu this year than last year. There is no doubt that this year the flu season will be worse than last year, but that's because last year was so good. There were very little cases." Dr. Olise Wu, chief epidemiologist and system director of infectious diseases for Hartford Healthcare, said. Wu anticipates flu cases will have a similar timeline as previous years, with sporadic cases through October, with more showing up in November and December before a peak in February. But he expects the flu could affect more people this year than last year. The two main reasons, flu shot hesitancy and people not wearing masks as much. Wu added, "There are some masking mandates, but for the most part, there is not mandated masking, and so because of that, this is a respiratory transmitted disease, and by science alone, when you take away a barrier, you are going to have more cases of influenza." As healthcare providers keep an eye on both viruses, there are some steps you can take to stay safe this flu season. Vaccination is still the primary way to prevent that, and I'd encourage everyone, including kids, to go out and get that flu shot this year. That's one really important step for prevention. Dr. David Banich with the Infectious Diseases Department at UConn Health said, "The masks provide that higher level of protection, so In crowded indoor environments, that can be helpful as well. Doctors are also recommending masking up for gatherings along with getting vaccinated and having outdoor get-togethers.
Aperture.
If you agree with me that travel is most rewarding when it surprises, then Iran might just be the most rewarding destination on Earth. By having lush, dense forests in the north, warm, sunny beaches in the south by the Persian Gulf, snowy mountains in the west, and amazingly hot deserts in the east, Iran is one of the few countries that gives the joy of experiencing four different seasons at the same time to travelers. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. With an area of 1.6 million square kilometers, Iran is the 18th largest country in the world and the second largest in the Middle East. Its area roughly equals the area of France, Spain, and Germany together. Iran's diverse and striking landscapes offer a wealth of breathtaking and spectacular views to discover. This week on Aperture's Iran Trotter series, Jawad Gharayi will go to Bahu Kalat in the south of Iran, where the turquoise waters meet the hot sand of the desert. Here's the first part.
The living world is filled with unparalleled beauties. Beauties represented by Mother Nature across this beautiful planet. A planet that's been the only habitat for humans since they came into being millions of years ago. The beauties of nature have forever captivated humans everywhere. Many of what humans have created over millennia were inspired by their natural environment. To many humans, the word nature conjures up images of mountains and forests, but nature has thousands of other beautiful facets, and some of those facets manifest themselves in sharp contrast to each other. One of the most beautiful faces of Mother Nature is the barren areas of land or deserts. Many nature explorers believe that deserts and steppes are the most beautiful parts of nature, and the most beautiful parts of these parts are the sand dunes and hills. But is there anywhere in the world with expanses of shifting dry sand dunes right next to a great body of salt water named the sea? Hi, I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of this beautiful land. Chile is a beautiful country with unique natural exquisiteness. A country that remarkably has vast steppes and shifting sand dunes along the coast of the Pacific Ocean, offering a natural scene of unparalleled beauty. Of course, I haven't traveled to Chile's beautiful Pacific coast. My destination is the Bahu Kalat rural district in the south of Iran's Sistan and Baluchistan province. But I'm not going straight to Bahu Kalat. I begin my trip near the border between Hormozgan and Sistan and Baluchistan provinces. There are few places in the world where sand dunes meet the sea, creating a spectacular landscape. Such coastal deserts can only be seen in parts of Chile, in the Great African Sahara, and in the Southwest African country of Namibia. Some may find it hard to believe, but in addition to those few places in the world, there is an area in southern Iran where expansive sand fields meet the Sea of Oman. A place near the village of Darak in Zaravan County. The border between Sistan and Baluchistan and Hormozgan provinces, in the southernmost area of Baluchistan on the coast of the Sea of Oman. In the past, this area of Iran was called Mukran, a name researchers say was derived from the word muk, meaning the palm tree. Given its large number of palm groves, Baluchistan can be referred to as the land of palm groves in Iran, an area with a beautiful history and peerless natural splendor. Unfortunately, the general public in Iran doesn't know much about Baluchistan. The sea, the sand dunes, and the Martian mountains, all in one place, provide an environment with no parallel in Iran and, I dare say, in the world. But the sand dunes, the Martian mountains, and the Sea of Oman aren't the only things that make this area of Baluchistan unique. It's the multitudes of palm and other trees scattered along this area, as well as the many herds of camels, goats, and sheep grazing among these dunes and mountains that make for breathtaking beauty.
Here, Mother Nature has made all her efforts to create some of the most beautiful coastal sceneries in the world, and she's done a great job. This is the result of millions of years of work for Mother Nature. So it's incumbent upon us and the authorities to keep these unmatched beauties just as they are, by not allowing any structures, however small, to be built here or in the surrounding area. Not even a few gazebos for tourists and explorers to use. We have to preserve this natural magnificence as it is. A geopark is a unified area that advances the protection and use of geological heritage in a sustainable way and promotes the economic well-being of the people who live in it. Geoparks are protected areas. Many countries dream of having one in its smallest and simplest shape and form. There are only a few geoparks around the world that are both geomorphologically rich and boast unique wildlife, history, culture, and indigenous populations. Countries with such wealth are few and far between. But this area of Balochistan is home to several morphological splendors. It's also inhabited by Baluch tribes of a rich culture. Their traditional lifestyle and time-honored customs, a pure, unspoiled natural environment, the preserved remains from the remote past, the golden sandy coastlines, and the deep turquoise blue waters of the Sea of Oman. The traditional fishing apparatus on boats moored at a beautiful port, and finally, very good vegetation and animal life. As I walk on beautiful sand hills, I think to myself, how are we responsible to the generations that will come into being in this country, to the natural beauties in our country? I'm spending today relishing the stunning untapped natural beauties in Zaravan and snap several beautiful pictures. The nagging question is, do we have the right to deny the children of tomorrow the opportunity to feast their eyes on such spectacular scenery? I wish no structure, no roads, nothing would be built among these ancient mountains, sand dunes, and palm groves. No hotels, no themed amusement parks to be built for human recreation on its untouched coastline. Even a few simple gazebos in the area can accelerate the destruction of this region's ecology and natural landscape. I wish all of us humans had more appreciation for the natural world, this manifestation of God Almighty's beauty, and paid it due respect. I wish all nature-loving tourists would choose to walk into the heart of nature, and by doing so prevented any harm to it. A lot of people in the world think that if they really want to enjoy their expedition into nature, they have to spend the nights in multi-star hotels near their destinations. But that's not the right mentality. It's not in anyone's interests. Hotels that are built close to natural habitats do nothing but damage an intricate ecology that's taken millennia to be formed. There's an alternative way for explorers to both enjoy their trips into the heart of nature and for the natural world to be spared damage by humans. In other words, for humans to forge a partnership with the natural world. Local homes, kapars, and black tents, and also camping tents are the best options. All the people and officials in this area of Balochistan say they hope that in the near future, the area they live in will be registered as an important and valuable geopark by the relevant authorities living in the capital city. And by doing so, they hope the unique natural environment here and the culture and customs of the old Baluch tribes inhabiting this region will be preserved and protected. I take great pleasure walking about in this beautiful natural landscape and accompanying camel herders, but this is the end of this leg of my journey. I have to set off for my main destination, the Bahu Kalat district in the north of Balochistan. The main purpose of this trip is to visit an idyllic little village by the name of Shir Gawaz, a lush, vast, green patch of land 30 kilometers to the border with Pakistan. The name Shir Gawaz was derived from the names of two wild animals, namely the lion and the boar. The locals here tell me this area is home to wild boars, but no one has ever sighted any trace of lions here or anywhere in Iran, unless in the very distant past. Perhaps what ancient Shir Gawaz inhabitants meant by the word lion was in fact the wolf or hyena. That's because those two species have lived in this region for hundreds of years. But what has brought me to this area of Balochistan wasn't the lion or the boar. I've come here to see the Asian crocodile. Parlance, this rare species of crocodile is called the Gondo. They live somewhere between River Sarbaz, Bahu Kalat, and Shir Gawaz. The river is the biggest natural stream of water in Balochistan. It is known by different names by the locals living in villages located along its 300-kilometer course. Monikers such as Sarbaz, Bahu Kalat, and Shir Gawaz. My team and I have to walk a long distance to see one of those short-nosed crocodiles. But these gorgeous, thick-skinned aquatic reptiles in Iran are said to be very shy animals, making it difficult for us to find one. What that means is you can't get too close to these amphibians and admire their beauty at close range. We have been going about gunning for a crocodile for a couple of hours now, but we haven't been able to see even one just yet. As I say, they are very shy animals. The locals tell me I'd be lucky to see one, though they also say if you wait long enough, you'll definitely be able to see at least one. Guide is around 3 meters long. The people in this area call them the Gondo. Who would have thought that you could see Gondos, the short-nosed Asian crocodiles, in a river in Iran's Sistan and Balochistan province? At their biggest, these majestic reptiles are 3.5 meters long. The primary habitats of the short-nosed Asian crocodile are in Iran, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Myanmar. The people of Shir Gawaz tell me the best place to see the Gondos is the Shir Gawaz Dam, a barrier built across the Shir Gawaz River to impound its water. The number of crocodiles living in Iran has been estimated at between 300 and 400. The good news is the people of Sistan and Balochistan do not do anything to endanger the survival of these adorable reptiles. The bond between them is unshakable. In general, the Baluch are kind, nature-loving human beings. traits that are rooted in these noble people's culture and creed. The love of nature and of animals is part of the life and culture of the Baluch people. Animals are part of the family, among them wild animals. Probably if this were another city or country, many people would try and, man, this guy is strong. I bet if I let him go, he's definitely gonna break my bones or break my camera into pieces. As I was saying, if this mountain goat were anywhere other than here, without a doubt some heartless poacher would have gunned it down by now. But the people here love animals dearly. The gondos that we saw earlier, they're conserving them so well. Also this wild goat, that's very close to the hearts of the people here. You can see many peacocks, partridges, and pheasants in the households here in Shir Gwaz, and also in other villages elsewhere in Baluchistan. The Shir Gwaz River flows past Bahu Kalad village, providing the hard-working community here with water for their farms, fruit groves, and animals. Perhaps there are many people in Iran who are unaware that the fruits grown in Baluchistan can only be farmed in tropical climates. But that's exactly what's happening in this province. All of the Iranian banana produce comes from this region. Bahu Kalad is also among the important producers of watermelons in Iran. The cold season is when the watermelons grown here are harvested and distributed across the country. I've just stepped into a fruit grove in Bahu Kalad. In my opinion, this is a veritable piece of heaven. Here, you can see several different species of fruits right next to each other. Something you may not be able to see anywhere else in Iran. Fruits such as bananas, dates, mangoes, papaya, all kinds of citrus fruits. I've also been told that even coffee is farmed in some of the gardens here. It's just wonderful. I mean, you could go so far as calling this place Little India, located in southwestern Iran.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
And let's say as COVID cases in the United Kingdom reach 40,000 a day, scientists think normalization is partly to blame for the lack of public reaction. We have prepared for you an article written by The Guardian's science correspondent, Hannah Devlin. The piece is titled, Why Britons Are Tolerating Sky-High COVID Rates and Why This May Not Last. One of the conundrums of the current phase of the COVID pandemic. The United Kingdom has among the highest number of infections across the world and a death toll that continues to steadily climb. Yet, officials claim national mood seems sanguine. So is this down to British stoicism, a keep calm and carry on mentality? Not according to experts. They talk of many factors being at play and warn it may not last. Linda Bold, Professor of Public Health at the University of Edinburgh, said, "We're in a phase where we still have large numbers of people dying from this disease," adding, "but it has gone into the background. We've become used to something that has not gone away. I think there's been a desensitization to the mortality." On Thursday, 14th of October, the United Kingdom reported more than 45,000 new coronavirus cases, the most since mid-July, and more than 800 deaths were reported in the past 7 days. Hospitalizations are rising, with one-fifth of intensive care unit beds occupied by COVID patients, and the latest figures showed an estimated 200,000 pupils absent from school. The United Kingdom is faring far worse than its European neighbours, with a rate of death per million people nearly triple those seen in France, Germany and Italy. However, officials claim the figures are still better than some predictions. Sage scientists said October could see 7,000 hospitalisations a day. In any case, it is not all about the statistics. Professor Robert West, a behavioural scientist at University College London, said, "When the COVID announcements were made, they'd say, very sadly, 3 people have died. Then it was, very sadly, 70 people have died." Professor West added, "Now they don't say very sadly. One thing we know about humans is our emotions are stirred by images. They're not stirred by numbers." The Bold, Professor of Public Health at the University of Edinburgh, believes current attitudes have been shaped by the Freedom Day narrative, the social contract made between the government and the public that if people came forward for vaccines, life would return to normal. She said, "A lot of people have bought into that. This includes some scientists." Linda Bold said, "There's some who are of the view that COVID is becoming endemic. It was always going to become endemic, and we just need to get on with it." Professor Linda Bold added, "Then we've got another group of scientists saying, look around the world at other countries that won't tolerate such high rates of infection, and what about long COVID?" Growing division in the community means that scientists are no longer providing a coherent argument, and to some extent the government can pick and choose which views it amplifies. Is there something particular to the British psyche, a stiff upper lip and internalizing of angst that makes the country appear relatively unshaken but the ongoing toll of the pandemic? Professor West said, "There definitely isn't. The British are supposedly much more safety conscious than some other countries, which you look at driving. When you look at driving, healthcare and safety at work, the way we approach public health." Professor Robert West noted This is something that is conditioned by the norms we see around us. When our leaders talk about COVID in the past tense, it gets through to people. Professor Robert West continued by saying, as a disease shifts from initial pandemic phase to an endemic illness, the data curves outlining its spread become less precipitous, and psychologists say this steady stream of daily deaths, although the United Kingdom is now on an upwards trajectory, tends to feel less alarming than the rises we witnessed in the first year of the pandemic. But Professor West added, we're built to react to change. We don't react to steady state. Something will have to change in people's psyche to make people feel like we need to do more about it. This may have been reflected in the Health Secretary's apparent lack of concern when asked on Thursday, 14th of October, about the continuing high rates of infection. Health Secretary Sajid Javid told Times Radio, overall things feel quite stable at this point. The numbers are a bit up, a bit down over the last few weeks. According to Professor West, accepting steady state is a question of framing. He said, there are steady states that appear troubling for humans, adding, by virtue of the fact that that is going to go on, the public may start saying, we can't keep having 1,000 deaths a week. A possible trigger for such a reappraisal maybe the continued strain on the National Health Service, the NHS. Hospitals may not be overwhelmed, but figures released recently showed that 5.7 million people were on waiting lists at the end of August, the highest figure since records began in 2007. Professor Tim Cook, a consultant in anesthesia and intensive care medicine, said, we're not back to normal. It's as simple as that, he added, with about 20% of intensive care unit beds and 10% of hospital beds occupied by COVID patients, there is no prospect of an imminent return to business as usual. Professor Tim Cook said, that proportion will continue to slowly occupy hospital beds for many weeks or many months to come. I don't see an end to this level of occupancy for quite some time. However, there is disagreement even among health professionals about what an acceptable steady state would be for COVID. Andrew Goddard, president of the Royal College of Physicians, said some still support a zero COVID model with an aim of having no cases, while others are accepting the current situation in which we have about 40,000 cases. Andrew Goddard added, we have all accepted, doctors included, 10,000 deaths from flu each year, so this tells us much about what we might accept with regards to COVID, although the impact on the most deprived parts of society and on certain ethnic minorities may reduce tolerance for such levels. It is not yet clear where the British public sits on this continuum, and some push back at the notion that there is an acceptance of the current situation. Professor Stephen Reicher, a psychologist at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, said, the idea that everyone is accepting the new normal is very dangerous. Then you reinforce a sense of fatalism. Professor Stephen Reicher points to a wealth of evidence in psychology showing that our behavior can be shaped to a greater extent by what we think others think than by our own beliefs. He said, if your attitude is at odds with a perceived social norm, you're less likely to act on it. According to Professor Reicher, the government has been systematically normalizing Britain's current rate of infections, he said.